Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Good Light Project is sponsored by the ADHD Aha podcast hosted by Laura Key. So I've been kind of amazed at how many conversations I've had lately with people later in life who are wondering if they have ADHD. It can be hard to understand what ADHD is by looking at a list of symptoms. So in each episode of ADHD Aha, you'll hear heartfelt interviews about the unexpected, emotional, even funny ways that ADHD symptoms surface for adults. Like the recent episode with ADHD coach Emily Weinberg, which really resonated with me. Her story about how she was thinking she was, quote, just lazy before her diagnosis because she wasn't hyperactive really struck a chord. Her feeling frozen and stuck, ruminating on mounting to-do lists is just so relatable for so many people. It's really validating to hear others articulate those experiences. Each episode of ADHD Aha features candid tales of realizing that you or a loved one has ADHD. You'll hear the unexpected, emotional ways that it manifests in adults through heartfelt interviews. ADHD Aha captures the authentic human experience of ADHD. So if you want a fresh, personal perspective that embraces the messiness, listen to ADHD Aha. Search for ADHD Aha in your podcast app. That's ADHD Aha with Aha spelled A-H-A. It's an aha moment you won't miss.
It's scary every time. And yet I find myself, it's almost like this magnetic pull, like going back, and I put myself in that situation. And yet I'm there in those situations at times thinking, what am I doing here? Like, how did this happen?
Imagine for a moment you're on a surfboard and you're screaming down the face of a 30, 40, 50, 60 foot wave, a wave that is so forceful, so violent that you literally, you're holding on for dear life. You have a helmet strapped to your head to protect yourself because if you take a hit with this wave, it could end your life. Well, that's a pretty regular experience for today's desk. Well, that's a pretty regular experience for today's guest, Iski Britton. She's one of the top women big wave surfers in the world. And she hails from Ireland, from surfing royalty, really, where she learned to be a part of the water and have the water part of her life in sort of the jagged cliffs and the pretty cold water of that country. We spent a lot of time today talking about what it's like to actually be in the throes of that, and also how surfing and how big wave surfing in particular really advises life. And how it teaches you so much about how to be in the world with grace, with calm, with ease, to deal with massive uncertainty and huge, huge challenge. Really excited to share this conversation today. I'm Jonathan Fields. This is Good Life Project. It's so good to be hanging out with you. So it's so funny. Like, we literally just met through a mutual friend. And as soon as I heard your story, I was like, I need to talk to you. And one of the first things that popped into my mind was Irish big wave surfer. I'm like, huh. Like, I never in my mind, like, associate, like, big wave surfing, even surfing. And I'm not, and granted, I'm not all that much in the surf world, but with growing up in Ireland also. So I'm curious, take me back a little bit. Like, how does this story begin?
Yeah, it goes right back to my very naming, Iski. It's the name of a place on the west coast of Ireland, and it's a famous surf break. Mm. So I'm named after a wave, and it's my dad's favorite surf break. He's one of the first pioneering surfers in Ireland, himself and his brothers, like back in the 60s.
And so is that kind of when surfing hit Ireland?
Pretty much. The surfing as we know it now, yeah. It reached Ireland around then. And they were the first to sort of start surfing in the Northwest in Donegal, which has now become quite a famous like surf spot for big wave surfing and other things. And the name Iski comes from the Irish word for fish, Isk. There's a lot in a name. Definitely say I have it in like salt water in my blood.
Yeah.
But I also grew up with it on my doorstep at a time too, and it certainly wasn't a cool thing to do, but it was just a way of life.
Which is kind of bizarre to me also, because like, to the association, when I think about like, surfing, it's like, that's the cool thing to do. So, like, it's so funny to hear you say you grew up in a culture where it wasn't the cool thing to do.
No, it was still considered like surf bums. It was like, it was still very like underground counterculture. Huh. Dad being a real nonconformist, and my mum surfed as well as a teenager, which was really unusual.
Yeah.
And when you grow and you're raised in that environment as a kid, you just don't question it. It seems natural. That's your home. And my playground was the ocean. And in a way, I think it was also the nature of where I was born, where I grew up. It's somewhere so isolated. It's really rural, Donegal. I don't know if you know Ireland, but it's like really on that northwestern edge, literally where the land meets the sea. It gets hammered by the Atlantic. And yeah, it's where really, I suppose I felt at home. Like I had this constant playmate, which turned out to be the ocean. Mm. I just connected it from such an early age. People ask me, when do you start? What's the memory of your first wave? Is usually a powerful one. But I think it's been, such a constant, like breathing.
Yeah.
I feel like I've been in the sea since before I can remember.
So when you're away from the water, what
is it? Oh, it's terrible. I'm doing okay right now. I have a lot of stimulus and inspiration here at WDS, but it's one of the issues with being a surfer, both good and bad. That constant pull of the ocean really is the best way to describe it. It's like it is an addiction.
Yeah, it's interesting too, because I'm not a surfer, but I grew up on the water. You know, when I was a kid, the end of my block was a beach, and that was that became the place that I would just go to sort of like, you know, like find, you know, like to touch stone, to just find my center.
Mm.
And so even though I don't have to, unlike you, it sounds like you love to be in it. But for me, it's really odd. I have to be near water for some reason. You know, we've looked at beautiful places to move that were landlocked, and I can't go there because it's like growing up, I think, you know, like on the water, basically, it just becomes a part of you, I think, for so many people.
Yeah, it seems like that's a natural thing. Like I'm biased being such a water lover, but it makes sense to me if you think about it and how much of us physiologically, how much of us is water, how much of the planet is ocean, and even how popular it is. Like people want to go to the coast and that's where all the development's happening. But it is that sense, and then being from an island nation, about this need to sort of reconnect with that. And it's this powerful force. But I think as a surfer too, it's because it's been such a, just this thing I've always done in my life, and I have never questioned it. I just love it that much. In the last few years, as I travel more and then mixing up in different worlds like this one, beginning to think like, well, what is it about surfing? Like, how has it influenced and impacted my life?
Yeah.
And it literally is infused in everything I do. And I wonder why I'm so restless. And I think it's like mirroring almost the energy of the ocean and that need to be, I think as a surfer, it really shapes your perspective because you're literally looking out always at the horizon, like sensing when the next wave is coming. And that's where I suppose the exploration, adventure, nomadic part comes in.
I really want to dive deeper into surfing as a metaphor for life and for all this stuff. But I want to just track your sort of journey a little bit. So you're in the water from like the time you're a baby, basically. At a certain point, you become, I guess, really interested in big wave surfing. Tell me what that is in the first place, because I think I probably don't have a real sense for what it is, and I'm sure a lot of people listening don't.
Yeah, it's an interesting world. I competed in surfing from when I was about 8 years old, and my family upbringing was also interesting. Like in my life, there's so many dynamic forces at play, which I think is not surprising given that I'm a surfer, and I feel that a lot with the whole thing of balancing. Again, life metaphor, I'll get to that. But the big wave surfing is, it's more about, for me, my evolution as a surfer was about the relationship with the wave. And what the reason why I competed was either to be able to fine tune some of those skills, but also to really meet other people and discover new places and travel. It was like a ticket to go away with the surf team. And
I guess the decision to compete or not compete in that world is pretty heated, right?
Yeah.
So tell me about that a little bit. So especially in the big wave world.
Right, in that, yeah, so that's another big topic.
But just in general, like, what's the conversation there?
It kind of goes against the grain. Like, where I'm at now, I think it's always been that way. Mm-hmm. There was this, and the reason I talk about in my family, in the household, dad is a total nonconformist, real, if you want to put a label on it, like soul surfer. Just doesn't see any place for competition in something like surfing. It's very much an art form. And funny enough, his eldest brother was very much the other way. He formalized surfing in Ireland, set up the Irish Surfing Association, was all about the promotion and the competition. It depends. It's a vehicle. It's just another aspect of it. So for me, it was this tool for a while. But really, at the heart of it, I now feel like I've got way more in tune with why I surf and how it's about how it makes me feel, in essence. And that I don't need competitions to discover that, to find it.
Right. I mean, through competition, when you do compete or when you were competing, was it more against the other people or is it more against sort of like your last best thing?
Well, that part of it is interesting because you really, if you start to make it about the other people, you're going to fail. And in a way, it doesn't matter, I think, win or lose. Probably my best learnings have been when I've lost. But it's very much about you have to break it down to that level of you, where you're at, your state of mind, and how that impacts how you are on the wave. And it's really just about the next wave and being in the right place for it. But if you make it about other people, and then you're in an environment you just have such little control over. It's constantly changing. It's not like a regular playing field. And so that's a really interesting process to go through.
I'm sure. All right, so take me into the move to, because I'm sitting across from you right now, and you've got like arms that Eric Kilta has. So obviously, incredibly strong, incredibly fit. But you're also you're a very compact woman who's like obviously just incredible. You know, like attuned to your own body and your own ability to perform. But it's funny. You know, like when I think about sort of like the legendary big wave male surfers, they're very often big guys, also like physically really large guys, and when you look at them on the wave, they look like they're just miniature. And it's funny, I saw a picture of you big wave surfing and it looks like you're wearing a helmet also. So let's kind of make that leap into sort of like you saying big waves.
Yes, big waves again, not an intentional thing. Like I didn't have my heart set on I'm going to be a big wave surfer. It was more about Ireland was changing and surfing was becoming a lot more popular. A lot of the other breaks were becoming crowded, the more accessible ones. And there was a small group who started to explore places that were more inaccessible when you had the emergence of the jet ski. So having this powered watercraft that you could use to get to places that you couldn't before. And that's how it really began in Ireland, like just trying to discover new parts of the coast. And what was fine were these really huge waves that have been breaking there probably, you know, for millennia. But now with the craft and the equipment to be able to access them and also having that speed and energy to be able to ride them. And so it was just really exciting that this sense of discovery could happen in my own backyard and I didn't have to go out there in the world to try and find it. And so I felt like it kind of found me in a way.
Yeah.
And it's just magical because one of the main spots is called Aileen's at the Cliffs of Moher, which is, it's like in the 7 natural wonders of the world, UNESCO site, like massively high sea cliffs. So it's a stunning, like powerful setting, natural setting. And this wave breaks at the bottom of it. And it rises out of really deep water. And it's just like the most perfect shape. It's like something you would draw in your copybooks as a kid. And I just really wanted to go see it, you know, just to witness it. And I got a call from friends. Actually, there's surfers from California, the Malloy brothers, who'd come over to connect with a local crew in Ireland. So there was a team and there was like water safety craft and a chance to really go out and see some of the best guys in action. And that's all I thought I was going to be doing. And so I was sitting in the lineup, and it's amazing experience just to be there that close to a wave that powerful. Like, you can feel the energy, all the senses are firing, the sound, the spray. Just you realize how small you are and how powerful this energy is. And it wasn't until like the very end of the day, it was almost getting dark, the jet skis are running out of fuel. I didn't have any equipment and never did it before in my life. But a friend came up to me, one of the drivers, and was like, just didn't really give me, didn't even ask. He was like, okay, right, Iski, come on, let's go. And we'd surfed together lots before, so he knew me. And I figured at that time is the best place to do it. You have all these really skilled watermen, and I just didn't really think about it. Mm. And I had all the wrong equipment. You wear an impact vest, like a extra layer for protection, because you're going at such speed that if you hit the water, you need to hold yourself together. And also a bit of flotation, because you get held under a lot more. And the board itself is a specialized piece of equipment, so it's a lot heavier. Because you're being pulled along, it's called tow surfing. Mm-hmm. So you hold on to this rope at the back of a jet ski. It's totally different dynamic because you're in relationship with someone else. You're really trusting your partner, the driver, who sets you up to get on the wave.
Got it.
And so you're very much along for the ride, and you have to be in tune, I guess, with that moment that you want to let go. That's your choice. And so the first time I didn't let go at all.
I was just going to say, I was like, there's no way. Like,
that's
right. It's like, I feel good. I'm safe. This is terrifying. It's awesome, but it's terrifying. I'm going to just ride this one now.
Yeah. What do I do? It's a very different sensation. And you're strapped in as well. There's like foot straps on the board, which is very alien to me. And yeah, but the next, so we went, so you circle back around for the next wave that's coming.
And how big waves are we talking about here?
I mean, the first time I did it, it was about like 15 feet.
Right.
Maybe some 20 footers that day.
So that's like 3 or 4 times higher than you almost.
A lot bigger than me. Yeah.
Right.
Definitely. It was a good 20-foot fate, like wave face.
Wow.
That I was on. Yeah. And it's funny because you're on it with all this speed as the wave's still growing. So you're going to lose that sense of the actual size until afterwards. And maybe you see a photo and was coming after me. And so, yeah, that moment of letting go is when you commit.
So you went back in.
Yes. That was, so I was hooked. I mean, it's such an adrenaline rush that you're being carried along by this wave, and God, it's hard to break down.
Is there a sense when you're in that place, like, are you feeling, are you scared, are you exhilarated, or is the moment just almost suspended? Like, it's almost like an otherworldly place, and like there isn't beyond emotion, beyond experience. It just is.
Yeah, because people ask me to break down the actual, like, that act of wave riding. How does that feel on those big waves? And that's really what it's more like. It's like this extended pause, suspended moment, like the real time ceases to exist. So it's really hard to describe. And it's the before and the after, like there's the build up where you're hyper-focused. And then really at that moment where you let go, it just shifts into something else because you've already committed. Like there's no going back, if you want to. And also there's no controlling the outcome. Like you have no idea what the wave might turn into. And you're just... You're picking your line and that's it, like trusting in that process.
Yeah.
And usually then it hits you when you've either literally hits you when you don't make it, or it hits you when you finish the ride and then you realize all that emotion and energy that was there kind of explodes. But it's not until afterwards you're aware of it.
Right. Tell me what does it feel like afterwards? Do you remember the first time afterwards?
Yeah. I was so giddy. a kid when they discover something totally wondrous that unicorns are real.
Wait, they're not real.
But it's that kind of childlike joy is the best way to describe it. Like there's nothing else matters. It's a heightened, it is a huge adrenaline rush. And just this amazing sense of euphoria. I mean, it lasts for quite a while, but not so long. So that's what keeps you probably going back for more. It is like getting your fix.
Which is, which I guess my guess is then. I mean, are there sort of two types of people? One person who you hit that end point and like the thing that happens in your brain is, oh my God, I want to do that as much as I can for the rest of my life. Take me back. And the other person is like, I've checked that off my list.
Never again.
Right. Yeah. Because I'm thinking I'd probably be the second person if I ever came close to doing anything like that.
It's a strange one because I always have this, like, it's scary every time. And yet I find myself, it's almost like this magnetic pull, like going back, and I put myself in that situation. And yet I'm there in those situations at times thinking, what am I doing here? Like, how did this happen? But it's really powerful. But that said, that was 2007 when that first experience happened with the toe surfing, big wave surfing. And it was many years before I really got back into that world. Mm. Mostly because it was quite a new thing. It's very tight-knit, very cliquey in a way. And to be honest, I was a woman.
And still are.
I still am. In that world, which is so heavily male-dominated, surfing anyways, and in the big wave world, there was no one else and still is no one else in Ireland, no other women doing it. And it's starting to connect with other women around the world. There's just not that many of us.
Talk to me about that a little bit more, just about sort of like the culture of surfing and women in that culture.
It's an interesting one in big wave surfing. I think it's where actually women are starting to make the biggest leap forward, breaking down that gender barrier that mostly exists in our perception around how the media want to play it out. Because in that world, although it seems really physical, it's so much more psychological. Like, you to be so emotionally in tune with yourself, it's your mindset that matters most. And I also think, like, what attracts me to it is the sense you're in this environment in big waves, and it just strips away all the other kind of bullshit or fears or doubts you might have. They pale into insignificance, and it really doesn't matter in that context, I think, whether you're a man or a woman. It's like, because it's such an intimate relationship with the wave and yourself, that none of those other things really come into play personally.
So what is it that's kept, I mean, you said it's still largely male-dominated field. What do you think it is that's kept, it's always weird to ask you, like, will you speak on behalf of all women? Which is always like a bizarre conversation. So I'm not even going to go, but just in your experience, like, what is it sort of like about the culture and the experience that's kept it still to this day, like many, like a long time after really surfing has become mainstream, still so much more men than women?
Well, there are perceptions, like there's a stereotype of what a big wave surfer should look like. And then as a woman, you come along and, you know, you look like me, and it doesn't quite fit the mold. And I think it's also a trust thing. And community is so important, even more so in big wave surfing. Even though it's such a solo pursuit, you really are on those big days also relying on each other. Like, you want to know you have each other's back. And so it just takes trust, like, to be. And you also have to, there's this sense of, doesn't matter whether you're man or woman, this applies. And you have to, like, you prove yourself, be able to be up for the task to literally, like, rescue someone, pull someone out of the water if they need it. And everyone knows what each other's capable of, and they trust in that. And for me, I got lucky because my tow partner is my cousin. Mm. Sort of that family bond.
Right.
I dragged him out into it. But the back to the gender thing, it was more maybe something that I like created a glass ceiling for myself, because I felt that people ask me, are you not really scared, or what's your greatest fear? And I was never so afraid of the waves. It was a different relationship with the surf, but it was more about this fear of other people's expectations and that I wouldn't quite measure up to them because I was a woman. Because it was when you do this, you're breaking new ground and riding what some people consider to be impossible waves. It's such an exciting thing, and it's always like, wow, the first woman to surf Mullach Moor, or that was such a big wave for a woman. I mean, if you're a guy, it's like, that's just an awesome wave, though. Wow. But the gender thing always kind of came into it, and I hadn't realized how it subtly gets in there. And you realize that I was out there, like, thinking, God, I can't afford to screw up, because if I do, then it'll be because I'm a woman. Yeah. Not because that was just a really nasty wave, and shit happens. And so, I'm happy to say I broke through that
Yeah. So it was more, you think it was more just internal with you? I mean, did you feel like if you had gotten taken out by a wave, not killed, but just, you know, like everybody has bad waves.
Yeah.
You know, like that people would look at it and say, well, that was, you know, like she couldn't take it because she was a woman instead of a man. Like, was that actually a conversation that was happening in your head?
I think it wasn't
and
that
I guess
explicit,
the second was, like, do you think that would have been legitimate? Like, do you think that judgment would have actually been made of you?
Well, it didn't happen to me, but I saw it play out for another female surfer who's incredible woman. She has really broken a lot of ground in the big wave surfing world, a Brazilian called Maya Gabeira. And she rode that wave in Portugal. It's gotten a lot of media coverage, Nazaré. And it's like the biggest waves in the world that have ever been ridden. And she had a really horrible accident there a couple of years ago. And there was this big media debate, and it like sparked up on, like, you know, national news stations here in the States and across Europe. But it was very much so about whether she was fit to be out there or not because she was a woman. Not that this, you know, it's such a crazy situation to be in. These waves are on the edge of what we should be surfing or not as human beings, you know, never mind, you know, for anyone. And that kind of shocked me and realized, well, that is actually a reality there. And I just thought, well, I don't need to own that because I don't really believe in that. So why am I letting that hold me back? And I felt it blocked my sense of belonging, like why I was really out there. I'd lost touch with that. I'd like disconnected from that. And I thought, like, yeah, I began to doubt maybe I shouldn't be out here. Like, what am I doing here? Right. And until I had this really amazing session, like literally it was the experience of one wave that I felt, you know, when you have those moments in life where everything aligns, it just flows. You're so in tune and you've something like literally breaks.
Yeah. So tell me about that wave.
Let go. I remember the date, even that's another thing in surfing, like literally a wave only lasts moments. And yet it carries through in your life as this really powerful thread, I think. And that was the 21st of December, winter solstice, 2013. And it was one of those days that was, there had been loads of swell, like lots of big wave days that had gotten lots of buzz. And when that happens, you get a big crowd and lots of media and it's really busy in the lineup. And this day it was more of a quiet one. It was kind of off the radar. It was really unexpected. It was just a window of a few hours where, like, all the conditions aligned, like the weather, the wind, the swell. It was building. And it's the biggest surf I've ever been out in. It's like 30, 40 feet on the faces. But just me and my cousin and a couple of our friends, like a really tight local crew who've trained together. And we just took it in turns. Like, so there's a team that would, you know, go out and choose the waves they want to ride. And then the other group would do the safety. Like, we'd watch out for each other. So that was lovely. And there was just another friend of ours, a photographer. And, like, that was it. And my mum on the headland for mum.
Right. Yeah. Freaking out, yeah. Like, just, like, praying.
Well, she takes photos. Like, she says that's her, like, you know, way of coping, like, looking through the lens of a camera. She has this, like, protective barrier. But it was that day where I realized what I really love. Like, I come most alive when I'm in experiencing, I guess, the beauty of nature, literally. It's, like, been like that since childhood. And I realized it was that simple. Like, I was out there because of my love for it, like, to be in this environment that was just so awe-inspiring, so powerful, like, that I was constantly, like, on this edge with myself, having to challenge myself and take that leap into the unknown, like, again and again. But it was such a personal thing, like, intimate. I owned it. And then the process of... It was one of those times where everything really slowed down for me, because I tend to be... I rush, like, really fast, one thing to the next, constantly moving, even sitting here. And that was a different day. Like, there was this stillness almost, and then that stillness stayed even in the movement, like in that act of wave riding. It was one of those rare moments where you get to slow it all down and become an observer, like a witness to yourself. And I think it was because I, instead of focusing on, like, even that day we went out, I thought, I'm just going to go out and look at it and then see how I feel. And then I got closer and closer, but those baby steps, but in each moment being really in tune with how I felt, like the breath, the wind, taking all of that in, but not just letting it, just processing it without really analyzing it. for once. And so there was no judgment on myself, no expectations. And it just opened up this space inside me, really. Mm. I kind of gave myself permission, like, yes, I do belong out here. Like, I want to be out here. We're amazing at being able to block ourselves from experiencing our own joy, I think. I don't know why that is fully, but I think it happens too when you're really passionate and driven. You kind of forget to just remember why you're doing it. Yeah. If that makes sense.
No, it absolutely does. I think we get so swept up often in the things that wrap around the thing that first brought us to a particular pursuit.
Yeah.
That sometimes we lose track of it. And, you know, sometimes it takes that moment where all the trappings are stripped away, you know, either because you intentionally do it or it just, you know, happens. There's a magical day that comes together where the circumstances set up right, where it's all that, that other stuff just isn't there. And you go back to that, like, you know, moment that, you know, lit you up about it in the first place. And so it's almost like you come full circle and you're like, that, you know, and it never leaves you when you find it again.
Yes, it doesn't. It's amazing. That was a real gift that day, like one of those turning points.
Yeah.
And it's like that, the other aspect of it too, it's like that relationship with the surfer and the wave again. It's like a mirroring process, and that you can only do that, like ride those waves. I mean, sometimes there's maybe an element of luck, but a lot less so when you're in waves of consequence like that. And it really comes down to that, like you have to let go. You can't hold back. There can't be any fear or doubt. And it really is like this, it's sort of a mirror to who you are and how, I mean, it's not about being fearless. It's rather about really embracing your vulnerability, which is, I guess, the bravery part, or what it really means to be without fear.
I guess there's a sense of surrender.
Yes. That's the word I think I was looking for. Yeah. Yeah.
You said that it's really so much more psychological than physical. Obviously, you're physically very strong and attuned and skilled at what you do. Psychologically, is there anything that you do to sort of prepare yourself for this? Or is it just doing it a million times that allows you to drop into it?
Yeah, it's a bit of both. I think that's been an interesting process, and surfing is an amazing tool for, like, a mindfulness practice like that. It comes back to tapping into that state of presence. If you're distracted or uncertain, it really plays out on those big days. If there's anything you haven't dealt with, it will come out, which is also interesting. So in that way, it's almost like therapy, but it's for the really challenging kind. And before, I used to say I wouldn't be able to sleep the night before. I'd be tossing and turning, and I realized that was because of the anticipation of what might happen the next day, and I needed a good night's rest. But instead of like telling myself, oh, you should or shouldn't do something, it was just this, using a lot of that, the mindfulness practice of being really present with whatever it was that I was feeling, like that's okay to feel that way. And that really helped. And just going through, like, having even really focusing on the practical things, like things that you can control. Like having my kit ready, checking the jet ski, loading everything up, like going through all those steps in a way also helps get you grounded.
So it's sort of like, it's not just the actual checking, it's the ritual.
Yes.
Of it that kind of drops you into, it's like signifies, okay, I'm moving towards this thing now, and I have to shift my mindset appropriately.
Yeah, and it's interesting too, because everyone has their own way of dealing with it. Yeah. And then I'm there, I'm with a crew of, it's all male. And so it's also interesting to see how people cope differently with, everyone also has their fears, like, and are in different ways cope with it. So some people, like some of the guys, they say they won't go to the headland and look at the surf beforehand, because it'll just freak them out. So that we launch at a harbor and you have to like drive around before you see the wave. And then other people go, no, I have to see it before I go out. And it's, you know, everyone has a different ritual.
Yeah. One of the things you shared was that, you know, when you were tossing and turning, you know, part of it was because you were concerned about what might happen. So we haven't really talked to me about what is it really like if you go down in a wave that size? I mean, I don't know if you want to go there.
Oh, yeah.
Or whether it's just like, you know, don't talk about it because of jinx or whatever it is. But, you know, just I'd love to get a sense of just the power and what it, like, when it doesn't go right on a wave that size.
It's hard because it's almost a case where you don't ever wish it upon yourself. But it's weird because you've gone a while where it hasn't happened. You begin to get worse. But it's happened a few times. In a way, it's an interesting thing because it's an almost an inevitability, like no matter how good you are, because it's such an unpredictable environment, anything can happen in an instant. And then all of a sudden you're in a situation that you don't want to be in, but you are. And so it isn't a case of, oh, I'll deal with that, you know, if and when it comes. So part of it is preparation, preparing for that moment. And that really helps psychologically as well. Mm-hmm. So to do that, you prepare with breathing exercises, like a lot of the free diving exercises and breathing techniques are really, really good. I don't think you could ever hold your breath for too long. But the other issue is that you can do that. You could hold your breath, you know, for like 3 minutes underwater, but you're still and you're calm and you're not being tossed around. But when a wave of that size hits you, it's like you just got punched in the gut in a boxing ring and you're winded. So you don't even have a chance really to get a breath before you're down. And then it's like a bomb explosion, right? This, you know, like a building landing on top of you, or an avalanche. And you have to go with it. Like there's no way you could fight against it. And that's like the worst possible thing you can do. And so again, it's like this big act of surrender and being really still. Like you have to almost relax into it, even though it's this, you're just being thrashed around like a rag doll. And I mean, there's some things you can do. You try to, you know, to make yourself small and hold on tight. But for the most part, you're better to go with it until it's ready to release you. And then you find your way to the surface.
So, I mean, how long could you be under for?
It's strange to tell. If you're under for like even 10 seconds, it feels like a minute. 20 seconds, 2 minutes. It feels way longer than it actually is because it's such a physical, intense experience, like workout with little air in your lungs. And so that's the thing why the psychological part's so important. You have to go to that calm, quiet place in your mind and not really think about what's actually happening. And if you train, then you learn to become really body aware and know that like what the signs are and what your body's telling you and not to freak out because you're actually capable of surviving far more than we think. Mm. And the importance of having, you know, really good crew training, the safety, like people might look at you and think, you know, you're just crazies in the water, but there's a lot that goes into it to make that moment possible. And then, then some things go wrong.
Have you ever been around a situation where things have gone really south?
I've definitely been out there when, you know, I've gotten hit by a wave, and then afterwards it's such a strange feeling, like you kind of don't feel like you've got very little control of your body because you've just been, it takes a while to like work through your system.
Yeah.
But I mean, the best thing to do is to, once you sort of regain your breath, to get back out there.
I mean, that was my big question, right? It's like, do you just sit out the rest of the day or are you on the next toe out because you want to sort of say like, no, I'm actually capable?
It depends. I think it's a personal thing again. Like I wouldn't push anyone to. And I've also been out there too. And you've seen, it's interesting what happens. Like I've seen some of the guys get a really heavy beating and be really shaken. Guys who are really gung ho and just, you know, kamikaze. And then all of a sudden they just say, no, not like today is just not my day. And it's happened too, where I've seen it happen to someone where they just haven't done it again.
That was it.
Like, yeah.
Wow.
And so it's a tough call. it's a high price to pay. Yeah, that's for sure.
So what keeps you coming back?
It's a strange one. Like I almost have this feeling of guilt if I'm not there on a day that's really firing and that I should be there. I need to show up. I'm getting over that now because I've made other choices in my life that have pulled me in different directions. And I think with the big wave surfing world, that's also an element of it. It's so driven and very single-minded. Like people who do it, who are really at the top of their game, that's all they do. It's like their 110% commitment all about chasing the next biggest wave and the next swell, wherever it may be in the world. And it's really admirable, but that's intense.
Yeah, but that's also not you. I mean, you've got, you know, the part of the story we haven't told yet is you'll say you have a PhD. I think environment and society, right?
Yeah.
You found a foundation. So, and now actually it'd be a great time to kind of circle back to what you were starting to touch on earlier, which is, you know, it seems like it's not just the practice, the art, the form of surfing that is a part of your DNA. It's the metaphor and what you've drawn from that as applied to life and career and all this other stuff. So let's dive into that a little bit.
Yeah, I think I'm really at the point where it's interesting in surfing because it's considered such a solo pursuit to the point of it being seen as something that's almost selfish. And it's all about finding the next perfect wave, or it's very individualistic. And yet, there's always such a strong community built up around it. Like, surfing doesn't just happen when you're in the water, I think. And it can be very much a way of life, and there's certain characteristics. And for me, it's also about now, because I feel a gift I've had my whole life. Like, it's definitely my first love. Constant love. Any relationships I have with others, I have to tell them this and explain that, well, surfing might have to come first. But that said, it's like, well, I've start now to sort of have a chance to take a look at how it's influenced me, and then think about how can I share how surfing's inspired me to experience the world the way I have, taking me out there, but also ultimately I think brought me back home to myself. It's an amazing tool for that inner exploration. And now, even like deeper than that again, it's like, how do you use something that you're that passionate about to create this like depth of understanding and connection with others, especially across these so-called barriers that we love to put up?
Yeah. So tell me a little bit more about some of the, because I want to get to a couple of things, and I also want to get to your trip to Iran, which I'm so fascinated by.
Yeah.
But on sort of like the notion of surfing as a metaphor to connect you with other people and to just as a lens to view the way that you experience life, what are some of the sort of like the big lessons that you think are just massively applicable to every interaction or the way that you just move through your day?
Yeah, and this is what I think is at the core of it. Like, it's not about surfing itself at all or wanting everyone to go surfing, but it's more about that, yeah, like this, that as a metaphor. And I guess how I like to think about it is like the surfer's way, and applying that to both, you know, ourselves personally, but also socially. And I think it's like some of the fundamental things for me is realizing it's this, like the power of the process, like that act of wave riding. And what that really is like being really present to whatever unfolds. And it's such a transformative space, and it brings such joy. And it's allowing that to happen without trying to control it or trying to put judgment on it and letting go of the outcome, which is a really scary thing to do. Right? So it's a lot about the risk-taking, being really honest with ourselves. You can't commit to a wave to take that drop if you hesitate and if you have doubt. So those are some of the big things. And then you actually really get into it, those moments of why you surf. It's because you have this, it's like you enter this heightened state of awareness. You have to be really present in yourself. And it's that flow that people talk about, but it really is that. Always think of it like surfing is more like water dancing. And there's this amazing quote, I'm not going to get it right, by T.S. Eliot, that talks about that, about how in stillness, that's where the dance is, at the still point. And I feel like that's often how it is in surfing, when you go back to talking about the experience of the actual wave riding as this suspended moment. And it's being able to do that, like to shift our perception of time in such a busy world, is a really powerful thing.
Mm. Yeah, I mean,
there's a lot in there.
Yeah, it's like we could break that down a lot of different ways.
Yeah.
The other thing that really jumped out at me from the, you know, what you mentioned earlier too, is the particular type of surfing that you're drawn to. There's this really fascinating blend that I think is also applicable to life and doing anything really powerful and meaningful between cultivating a fierce level of self-reliance, but simultaneously a fierce level of trust in the people that you're there with, you know? So it's like this really interesting duality that you're holding.
Yeah. Yeah, and I didn't even like fully think about that so much until like more recently about the trust part and that sense of community that exists. Yeah.
At PhD. like, where does it fit into this whole
thing? Oh, boy, where does it fit? Yeah, I'm like, oh, yeah, that thing.
Right. It's like, because it's funny, I'm reading it, I'm like, yeah, learning about you, and I'm like, this is fascinating, it's so cool, Soul Surfer, and just like, and then I'm like, where does the PhD, like, how does that come into, because that is an intense commitment to education. Where does that come into your, sort of the journey for you?
Yeah, I have to remind myself sometimes. You know, it's funny because it almost parallels that transition with, so I'd been really, I'm still really nomadic, but I traveled a lot from when I finished high school, especially like late teens into my early 20s, just traveling around the world solo, experiencing the college of life, as Dad calls it. But my decision then, I guess I'd always wanted to go to university because by going out into the world, it only just fed my curiosity and wanting to know more. And I felt like knowledge was a great bridge. But the PhD, it was funny because I thought, well, this is an opportunity. I got offered it in Northern Ireland, University of Ulster. I'm like, great, it's an opportunity to be at home. And I think I'm ready to be a bit more grounded. And then there's this big wave surfing thing that's really taking off. And, you know, it's quite strong. And it'd be great to have like a home base to be able to explore that. And at the same time, do the PhD. So, and I was still competing. I competed up until the last year of my PhD as well. So my surfing also really took off in a whole new way at the same time as I was getting deeply immersed in this headspace that's a PhD. And I think I probably couldn't have done one without the other. Hmm. It was a real disciplining time. And then I needed the surfing as the release as well. Like I couldn't have done the PhD if I wasn't also surfing, but it's a tricky balance.
Yeah, I would imagine. And it's funny, I could see the relationship where it's like it would be, you know, the surfing was a really powerful release for the stress and the intensity of the PhD. But it's interesting, it's like, how is the PhD sort of like necessary, like to do the surfing? I mean, I guess it's really feeding two very different parts of you.
Yeah, it's also that coming to terms with that there are all these different parts to me that make up the whole.
Yeah.
But it's very hard because especially in that world, as I became like more and more part of it in academia, you get over how many years undergrad, like 7 years of being institutionalized almost and having that depth of training and skill in that kind of a craft. And then having this lifelong craft of surfing and all these other things in between. And this creativity and artistic background from my parents. But yet you're being very much boxed in, especially in something like in an academic setting.
Yeah.
And even in surfing, it's like, so when are you going to be done with your studies and let's go surf? And then you're in academia, it's like, when are you going to, you know, commit to being in your disciplinary box? And yeah, so that was...
So it seems like your answer to both worlds was I'm not.
Yeah.
but so interesting to me also because you said earlier that in the world of big wave surfing and, you know, it's the type of thing where it's like you're 110% in. You know, it's like the people who are doing this, it's like it consumes absolutely every part of them and like that's their lives, 110%. And you're kind of saying, and my curiosity there was, you know, is that because to stay alive in that world, you have to be that fiercely devoted to it? Or is that just the expectation in the culture or some blend of it?
Yeah. I wonder now because it gets back to the competitive part too.
Yeah.
For me, what attracted me to the big wave surfing world when I really get down to it was also this environment of collaboration that was so different to how it had been in the competitive world, which is really isolating. And then seeing how the competitive element, because industry and money and commercial side is really behind the competitive scene. And it also offers sponsorship, which offers a livelihood, which, you know, they sell it as this is, you know, you can do what you love and you get paid to chase big waves. What's not to love about that? But there's an edge to it. Like the dark side is that then it becomes a different thing. And I wonder how much of it is, like, I've seen how frustrated some of the guys get when they don't get the biggest wave that day. They're like, they're absolutely gutted. They see someone else get it and they know that, damn, that's the cover shot and it's not theirs. Or yeah, just this, I mean, as surfers, I don't think we're ever satisfied anyways, but to see it amplified because it's, or the pressure to perform, and the pressure to perform in those situations is just really dangerous.
Right, I would imagine. Did you ever do sponsorship, or did you feel that when you did?
I guess I was lucky in a sense, well, you can see it as lucky or not, but I was with this like smaller company and never given that much money. It was kind of enough to feed my habit. And I also had a lot of freedom then to manage my own budget for the year, to decide how best I wanted to use it to get the results that they would be happy with and that I could fulfill what I really wanted to do, which was to travel and experience new places. And now it's evolved into a place where I guess my whole story is what matters to people now. Like, I don't have to be different e-skis in different worlds. It's all coming together in a way that's really exciting, and I can see it happening in surfing as well. I'm with a company called Finisterre. It's like a cold water surf brand, but they're really like, they're almost like family, very small grassroots, and very much about the quality of the product, being local, sustainable, thinking about the design, like the whole process, being, I suppose it's about the integrity of it and not compromising. And of course then you lose out on certain things, but it matters a lot more.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so you have to, you're always deciding like what stays on the table and what comes. And talk to me more though about how you come to this place where you're realizing it's the entirety of, you know, like the e-ski story. That's not just, you don't, it, there doesn't have to be sort of like a separateness that that both is drawing people's interest and also like is allowing you to build your own unique thing that, you know, you're defining along the way.
And what made it possible was realizing what I already had, what I already have, which was, hey, I've been doing this thing, surfing, my whole life. And it's been giving me an amazing set of tools to be able to cope with a lot of life's challenges and how I make decisions and cope with things. And I felt like I was being offered a lot of opportunities, which were really exciting at a time when you think, God, this doesn't happen. I should say yes, and going along for the ride. And then realizing that that wasn't of my own creating, and I was being kind of funneled into this box. And I thought, well, I'm most comfortable when I step out of a comfort zone and when I'm moving into the unknown and challenging, I guess, the edges of who I am and exploring that. But also it's now gone into more about what happens when I do that in places like Iran.
Yeah. So you end up starting your own foundation,
which was also not intentional and very organic. I mean, it literally started out with just being that adventurer part of myself, wanting to do, I guess, shift my own perspective of how I thought of the world, and then going to a place that a lot of people thought wasn't a good idea to go for, you know, to go surf, which is this southeastern corner of Iran. And it's definitely not a typical surfing destination. And I was motivated really by the sense of, oh God, just my own, shocked by my own ignorance of how little I knew about the vastness that is Iran, the Persian culture, and then discovering that it even had a coast exposed to any ocean, like the Arabian Sea, Indian Ocean. And yeah, that just it being a total unknown.
Yeah, so tell me about that experience.
And at the time, this was the first time I went, was 2010, and I just didn't really think about the combination of being a woman, surfing, and Iran, and having my head covered. It seemed to attract a lot of attention too. And it's been an incredible story that I think is still growing and now being told by lots of different people, which is really interesting to see how that's all come about. And it's never something I would have imagined possible. Like when I first went there, literally went with my surfboard, thought may or may not find waves. Everyone else who was supposed to go on the trip fell by the wayside for one reason or another, except one other woman who was Marion Poiseau. And she had a camera with her and was this, you know, aspiring filmmaker. And I had my surfboard And we decided we should, you know, carry on regardless. We're here now. And it was just that sense of, let's make the most of it against these odds. And the shift for me then with that whole experience was really about reconnecting with the values of surfing, why I did it, why it mattered. And it wasn't really about searching for the next wave, but really how it opens this space to connect with people. Like surfing didn't, there was no one surfing there, and there was no surf culture, no scene. So it was like this blank canvas in that sense.
Right, so you just drop into Iran.
Yeah.
And this, and where there's no surf scene, there's nothing, and you're there to surf.
Yes, basically.
And I mean, so, I mean, the first time you went, was this largely about like a very personal quest for you to do this thing, or was it your intention to see if you could somehow connect with culture or bring other women into it? Or
yeah, there was, so that wasn't my intention the first trip at all. I didn't know how it would even be received. Yeah. If we'd get permission to do it.
Right. Were you concerned about sort of like how it would be received?
I was probably, I don't know, naive is the right word, but I, you know, in a way, we'd also put in a lot of the organizing part of it had was with a mutual friend of ours who'd organized everything. And we did it with a local tour company the first time. So that was our, they were like our, I suppose, the gatekeepers. It wasn't completely solo. But they'd also never been to this part of Iran, which is like Chabahar is the main city. And the rest of it is incredibly rural, very remote. Other Iranians don't go there. Like, you tell people in Tehran you're going there, they're like, what? Why would you go there? And it's considered quite a backwater. It's different ethnicity, Baluchi people, and they speak different language. They're a Sunni majority. It's a different religion. Discovering all of this was really incredible as well. But the first trip was really, in a way, it wasn't until afterwards I had left. And Marian made a short film, like 5 minutes of me surfing waves off this desert coast in a place that no or not many people had really surfed before, and no one, women had surfed there as far as we were aware. And that's what sparked the whole reaction. That was the catalyst to go back.
So what was that reaction?
And the response really surprised me. I thought, well, it could be pretty mixed. Going to somewhere like Iran, you're a white Western woman, bringing something like surfing. But that wasn't my intention to bring surfing and convert the masses to try this amazing, you know, sport. And it was very personal. And there wasn't any real message. It was just like, this is the experience and this is what it looked like through a surfing lens, this place we know so little about. And also, I think the other thing that made it really possible to go back and do what's happened since was the fact that I went and kept my head covered. So I'm surfing and I'm completely covered, and it's in the desert, it's 40 degrees Celsius. And the most challenging thing I thought was thinking about, yeah, what am I going to wear? And how am I not going to, you know, die of the heat? But that also was, I suppose, it's that thing when you travel and you're in somewhere that isn't your own, it's not your world. It might not be rules that you agree with, but it's that having that, I suppose, that sense of respect or trying to understand what it's like in someone else's shoes, right?
So then you went back.
Yes. And this is where it gets interesting, because the reason I went back was because, and this is why also the internet's a beautiful thing right now when you talk about storytelling and trying to open up space for the diversity of these voices and what it means to be a surfer, who do they look like. And so I discovered this whole community of sportswomen in Tehran doing board sports like snowboarding, skateboarding, wakeboarding, and using their passion for that to, I suppose, be who they really wanted to be, to express themselves in a different way.
Was that a big shock, by the way, like discovering that?
Yeah, you know, for them, it's not like this is what I was going, but it's not a story that you hear about Iran very often. About these women, despite the challenges and the obstacles that they face, still being able to do what they love doing, and then getting excited by the opportunity to try something in their own backyard, and not having that up until this point because, it needed to be another woman teaching other women and girls to do it, and also, yeah, just not having access even to the resources, and it being such a remote part of the country. And so the going back was almost on invite from the community there, like wanting to, hey, like, when are you coming back, and can we try this? And so they were the real risk takers, I thought, because it was one thing maybe for me to go, but we went with, it was myself and Mona Siraji, who's a professional snowboarder, and Shala Yassini, who's a swimmer. And they were the first two to sort of come along. And then we had a lot of discussion about, you know, it's a big unknown, and we're not sure, we don't know how people will respond. And so, like, for the first few days, Marian came back with this also, like, to capture the story of it, which has become a documentary since called Into the Sea, just been released this year.
Goal was to introduce these Iranian women to surfing.
Yeah. And
or was it something else? Because the look in your face kind of made me think that's not quite it.
It was more, for me, the excitement, I suppose, in a way. I hadn't realized what it was like when I grew up in Ireland before surfing was cool, and tapping back into my experience of what it was like to discover surfing for the first time, and then wanting to understand what that was like for these women and girls to experience that in their own country for the first time, like almost revisit that experience, and also better understand, like, what is it that connects us or drives us to do those things against the different challenges that we all face as women. And it became even more than that, because where we had to go to surf, because it's this region that's very culturally, socially different to the rest of Iran, it was also bridging the social and economic divides that I didn't anticipate. And surfing then really became the vehicle or the tool, whatever you want to call it, that opened up this space that just wouldn't have happened otherwise, for people to connect with each other over a shared experience, like something that's as fun as surfing, you just never would have considered interacting with each other before. So both the gender, like men and women, that being mixed, and then also this cultural thing of the sort of middle class urban Tehranis coming and going somewhere like that with like local, like tribal communities and sharing waves for the first time. It was really powerful. Mm. And in a way, it was, so surfing was a lovely catalyst, and it's such a great medium. Because it was so new, there was no blueprint. So even the powers that be so far haven't been able to box it into any particular category. And what's really exciting is that it was my hope that people would experience it and make up their own minds how they feel about it. And a lot of us going the second time was asking people, you know, telling them, this is who we are and what we're doing, but like, what do you think about it? What do you think about women doing it? So it was terrifying, because you'll see in the movie, like, it was almost the very first day we get to Chabahar and meet with the political leader who was in the government at the time. And he's this big, you know, bearded guy and has this huge entourage of all men. And I go up and I can't speak Farsi, Persian, asking him through a translator, you know, hey, what do you think about women surfing with my pink surfboard? And I gave to him. There's this classic photo of him standing there with this pink board going. But it was interesting to understand, you know, where the spaces lie, even with the rules, and exploring that. And then also seeing how they're taking it and making it something of their own. Like, it's like this, how they want to be as a community themselves. And so Mona, along with her friends, in collaboration with the local communities in this part of Iran, have set up a community group called We Surf in Iran, and in essence another foundation to be able to sustainably develop it and keep it accessible to everyone.
Oh, that's great.
So that's really exciting. Like, it's got a life of its own, which is great.
And it's like it opens this whole new, I don't want to say application of surfing, but it's sort of like, you know, surfing as this modality to connect cultures and sort of like share experiences where people might never realize their commonalities.
Yeah.
But for that modality. And it's a fascinating modality too, because like you shared like earlier in a conversation, it levels the playing field. Yeah. You know, the wave doesn't discriminate.
Yeah.
So it's gender neutral, it's on every possible level, it's neutral. So it's a really interesting mechanism to sort of like to bring people into and let the lessons emerge from a place where bias can't exist.
Yeah, it's like getting back to the heart of it for me. Yeah. And that's really now where I'm at, how I see it, is channeling what I love most, surfing, into social change. And then how do you make that, how do you scale that, make it bigger, go from that like one experience, which is pretty unique in Iran, but how do you connect that with a bigger picture of what's happening globally? And that's what inspired the Surf Plus Social Good Summit, which I just had a couple of months ago. And it was very much inspired by, you know, that's part of the reason why I really wanted to come to WDS, was to get a better understanding of the whole, how I see like this art of gathering, how you can build community today and all these different channels for doing it. But it's fundamentally about connection and wanting to feel a sense of belonging.
Yeah, I think when it comes down to it, almost everything is.
Right.
Like when you strip it all away, that's such a fundamental, essential human need. Which kind of brings us full circle. So the name of this is Good Life Project. So if I offer that term out to you, to live a good life, what is it? What comes up? What does it mean to you?
It's a beautiful way of putting it, I think, to live a good life. And it's, for me, I think it's funny. Okay, I'll take a step back for just a moment. And before I came here, the last month has been incredibly tough. Just, it's been a real disciplining, challenging month where it's really, I heard today in one of the talks, like the universe has got your back, but the universe will also tell you, remind you that it has your back and that you know, so for me, it was about this thing of needing to really slow down and take care of myself, especially when you're in service to others and you're so fueled by your passion. I think those of us who are like that tend to be not so great with the self-care part. And so I think a lot of it is to live a good life is, you know, to be kind to yourself, to be honest about who you really are, who you want to be, and listening first to yourself so that then you can better tune into your environment and then through that connect with other people. And a lot of it too is also, you know, about forgiveness, like be kind to yourself, forgive yourself, love yourself. And from there, then I think you can better connect with who you are and accept all of it. And that's the first part of the journey, that inner part. And the next part to living a good life is how do you bridge that, the inner and the outer world, which I think is what literally happens when, you know, that the experience of surfing is that for me. Yeah, so it's being open to those experiences that allow us to dissolve those barriers again that we put up and to better connect with who we are, and through that being able to connect with our environment, and then we're better able to like care for it and share with others. So that's what it's about.
Beautiful. Thank you so much.
Thanks. It's so powerful doing this.
Hey, thanks so much for listening to today's episode. If you found something valuable, entertaining, engaging, or just plain fun, I'd be so appreciative if you take a couple extra seconds and share it. Maybe you want to email it to a friend, maybe you want to share it around social media, or even be awesome if you'd head over to iTunes and just give us a rating. Every little bit helps get the word out, and it helps more people get in touch with the message. I'm Jonathan Fields, signing off for Good Life Project.
This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode, and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.